We all know that there's feminine and masculinity inside of us, and part man, part woman. I think that there's a 16-year-old girl inside of every man, and I really wanted to embrace my fantasy of what it must be like and everything that comes with that. Everything I do comes from a very fetishized approach. You know, it's all fantasy for me, and it feels great.
Director Nicholas Winding Refn on his splashy, electro-fused horror, The Neon Demon. More from him shortly. From Midori House in London, this is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Also ahead,
the color of LA is probably the sunset colors.
We'll cross to Los Angeles to hear from The Neon Demon's cinematographer, Natasha Breyer. Plus,
found out he had been working on developing a project with David Bowie.
From directing Madonna to a career cut tragically short, we'll speak to the nephew of renowned filmmaker Howard Bruckner. And a little later,
Larry said he would never stand in my way, whatever happened. But the word failure is not part of my vocabulary.
We'll cap off Nicholas Winding Refn's special curation of films on Mubi with a look at Gus Van Sant's 90s classic To Die For. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, welcome to the show. It's tempting to think that director Nicholas Winding Refn's breakthrough film came in the form of a brutally mute Ryan Gosling in 2011's crime thriller Drive. Of course, it was actually his debut way back in 1996 that put him on the cinematic map. Pusher was an immediate success in his native Denmark, taking us again into the dark underworld of violent thugs and the undesirables that aid them. It became an influential force that spawned two sequels, plus a Hindi remake, and later a British one too. His latest film, The Neon Demon, is among other things a masterclass in movie marketing. Long before anyone knew exactly what to expect, a series of eye-catching bright pink poster artworks were tantalizing the neon appetites of hungry, perhaps slightly demonic, audiences. The film has finally arrived in cinemas today. Here's Nicholas Winding Refn speaking to us about how the film came together.
I think that I wish I had your hair.
Is this your natural color?
You're just so beautiful. Don't you think that she's just perfect?
You know, we all know that there's feminine and masculinity inside of us, and part man, part woman. I think that there's a 16-year-old girl inside of every man, and I really wanted to embrace my fantasy of what it must be like and everything that comes with that. Everything I do comes from a very fetishized approach, you know, it's all fantasy for me, and it feels great when I make it. I don't really have an interest in the result because I live through it in the process. But I thought doing a teenage horror movie about a 16-year-old girl was a way to entertain my own idea of what it must be like to have been born beautiful. Well, I don't storyboard my films, and it always starts from I have an idea. And I had this idea one morning because I woke up and I realized I was never born beautiful, but my wife is, and I wonder what it would be like. You know, my children are very beautiful, but they're also at the age of discovery of narcissism, which in their generation is much more celebrated and accepted than in my generation. And, you know, the idea that the obsession of beauty will only grow and the longevity will only shrink. So what's going to happen when there's nothing left and everything just becomes younger and younger? And that to me was like a terrifying fairy tale. So that was like the basis of what I thought.
Is that your real nose?
Yeah.
God, life is so unfair.
Gigi just got out of the body shop. She's still a little sensitive.
you had work done.
You say that like it's a bad thing. Sweetie, plastics is just good grooming. Imagine going a year without brushing your teeth.
I wanted to make a film essentially about beauty and not a statement of women. I needed women in the process to help me take it to a certain place in outer space where the feminine standpoint would then be released and it would then travel into this orbit of a horror film about beauty. I happened to be interested in seeing it from a 16-year-old girl's point of view because I'm surrounded by women at home and I'm surrounded by beautiful women, and I thought there's also something incredibly scary about this. So, you know, I also used a female photographer. The cast is predominantly women, certainly all the significant roles. All the men I wrote as the girlfriends of other films.
What was that?
I can never figure it out. I can't sing, I can't dance, I can't write. No real talent. But I'm pretty. And I can make money off pretty.
L.A. was the only place my wife wanted to go, so people would say, well, if you want to do the fashion, well, you got to go to New York, you got to go to Paris, or if you want to do this, I want to do that. And I was like, yeah, but I think L.A. actually is much more interesting, because if this was the Wizard of Oz, then the wizard would be Hollywood and Dorothy would be traveling there. Because Hollywood is a kind of sponge of everywhere else in the world, and everything leads to Hollywood and then it beams back out. So L.A. became this mythical place that I found much more interesting, because I certainly didn't want to make a movie about the fashion world. I mean, there's so much good television that deals with that. So, and I don't have really an opinion about that world, because I love it like everyone else does. But I'm also entertained and I find it, I got young girls, so of course I'm confronted with that every day.
Of course I love him. Look at me. He calls me the bionic woman.
Is that a compliment?
Nicholas Winding Refn, director of The Neon Demon. Now, of course, very few films are purely the result of one creative mind. Hundreds, sometimes thousands, of people are involved from the initial conception right through to the end credits. Chief among those responsible for the visual style is the role of the cinematographer. And in the case of The Neon Demon, the visuals are as much a leading role as Elle Fanning's blood-soaked aspiring fashion model. I spoke to the film's cinematographer, Natasha Breyer, in Los Angeles.
I think Los Angeles was another character in the movie, and the movie works so much with the archetypes. It was important to somehow photograph that essence of LA. So it's about the neon lights and the dreams of success and the promises.
When you're looking at the city from a purely visual sense, trying to give people some sort of emotional feeling simply by the way the city looks on the screen, what are some of the things that you pick up on?
This is very interesting that you're asking me this, because these were our initial conversations with Nicholas, both of us being foreigners in LA. So we talked a lot actually about that, about our perception as outsiders, you know, how LA feels when you arrive, and when you're arriving with all these promises and dreams. And I think the color of LA is probably the sunset colors. And the palm trees are super important, because it's like the first thing that makes an imprint on you. You arrive, and once you see the palm trees, you're like, oh, yeah, yeah. That's what I've always seen in the movies.
Talk to me about the early stages of how you were forming your ideas of how you would tackle the challenge of putting the Neon Demon on screen.
I didn't have a lot of preconceived thoughts early in the process. I always try to absorb as a sponge as much as I can from my directors before starting to think about shots. So in the early weeks of preparation, I tend to talk a lot about scripts with the directors. It's like a kind of a very deep script analysis. So it's like a kind of investigation journey, trying to get inside the director's head. So with Nick, yes, he doesn't do storyboards, but at the same time, he's very visual. You know, we spent 2 months going to a lot of different locations, and you start to get a feeling of what are going to be the parameters that you're going to be using, what's going to be your palette. And when we were doing the location scouts, I took a lot of photos. And then what I would do after our conversations, I would do like an edit of the location photos and do some kind of graphic storyboard with the photos. And I would add my notes and I would paint with the colors that I wanted to light it. So that would be a working document that I would show to Nick and that we would probably review every day during the shoot before we arrive, before we are going to start shooting. We would take a look at that document with those notes, and maybe that would be the starting point, or maybe we would look at it and say, well, this made sense 2 months ago, but now the movie, it took its own character and it developed its own language and now it doesn't fit so much anymore. And then immediately, of course, we would get to think about, you know, a new idea and what works with the language that we've been developing.
Natasha Breyer, cinematographer of The Neon Demon, out in theatres now. Still to come, we'll speak to the nephew of renowned film director Howard Bruckner about restoring the legacy of his late uncle. Plus, another look at Nicholas Winding Refn's special curation of films, this time focusing on Gus Van Sant's To Die For. Stay tuned.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Because life is too short for bad films.
I'm Ben Ryland, and this is The Cinema Show. Throughout the mid-1980s, Howard Bruckner was an auteur in the making. Having just finished his well-received documentary on writer William S. Burroughs, he would soon begin work on a second documentary, followed by the Prohibition-era comedy Bloodhounds of Broadway, starring Madonna, Matt Dillon, and Jennifer Grey. However, before Bloodhounds ever hit a theatre screen, Bruckner's life was cut tragically short by the AIDS crisis. He was just 34. Uncle Howard is a new work by the director's nephew, Aaron Bruckner, dusting off reels upon reels of old footage buried in the bunker of William S. Burroughs. The film is a touching exploration of a largely overlooked talent. I spoke to Aaron Bruckner and the film's producer, Paula Vaccaro.
It came out of a real love of my uncle and not wanting to see him die a second death of having his work forgotten. It was as if his whole life had been frozen in time in that moment when he died at 34 years old, and it was all still so fresh. So that act of looking for a film, which was his Burroughs film, kind of awakened all this stuff, all this memories in me, in Howard's friends who we were talking to, and the people he worked with. And it started to, for me, connect to, you know, that little boy who I had been, and how I looked up to this man and had this opportunity to revisit that space and get to know him as an adult and as a filmmaker and rescue that story so I could keep it with me and not have it forgotten like his film was.
So he obviously played a significant role in your life, and that has played into how you've shaped this film as well. But the film is also quite specifically about Howard himself. How did you reconcile those two things and make sure that you were going to get both across without maybe one overshadowing the other and maybe your recollections taking over the film and obscuring what you were trying to get across?
Yeah, it was very hard. I mean, it was a real challenge. I wanted to tell a story about a filmmaker who most people don't know, whose daddy's not with us, and whose work is largely unknown. And these were like, you know, three strikes against it. So I think the way that we decided to approach it, to try to walk that fine line, was to make it a film about the process and about the journey. And so to keep that journey fresh of discovery, because it really was, I mean, while I had memories, as everyone had memories, the freshness of the discovery of what we were finding, both as far as films and videos were concerned, but also the many different sides of Howard, that nobody knew all these sides that he had. So to keep it in that kind of fresh state, I think, was the best approach we could have to bring in the audience so that the audience could be engaged in the process, engaged in the story, and also share in that kind of sense of discovery.
Paula, tell me about how you came on board with this film and how you maybe tried to steer it in a way that ensured that it became a film that could be seen around the world and wasn't maybe too much of a pet project.
Well, I came on board on the project as Aaron's producer because our company mainly focuses on the director and what the directors do. So we produced his first film, and so we produced the second film, and we're going to produce his third film. I think the challenges from the production side were the film had very well-known names like William Burroughs or Robert Wilson, Madonna, you know, people, New York City, all those things. And a lot of people wanted the film to be just about that. And they felt, oh, maybe if it's too personal, it will become very small. And I think I always felt that we needed to help Aaron find the story and that Aaron needed to be even more so at the forefront. So if anything, as a producer, I try to provide the resources for him to be able to work. And keeping the partners that supported the film on a good balance between the European Union that supported the film, which without their funding, we would not have been able to do the film, the American partners, foundations, investors, other companies. So really trying to strike that balance so the film had a big community to actually pull it through. And then, of course, having Sundance Film Festival and Berlinale, both the American and the international premieres, would really help the film come through as the myriad of things that it was.
Aaron, when you were first approaching the film, did it feel like a small story to you?
Well, it felt in two. You know, when I looked at the home movies that I found and Howard's video diaries, that felt very personal and very intimate. And yeah, maybe small. But the other side was these other factors of Howard's life, which felt huge. You know, AIDS, New York City, William Burroughs, Robert Wilson, you know, the whole countercultural movement that came out of New York in the late 70s and 80s, gentrification, you know, like kind of massive themes. So it was like I had this small personal thing and these real big themes. And it was a real challenge to fit it all in because I knew the personal, it was interesting for me, but it wasn't enough to justify, you know, a large film that would reach a wide audience. And the big themes were fine and big, but, you know, impossible to get across without writing a book unless there was a tight story. So it actually had to really come together. And that was, you know, one of the big challenges in the edit was to navigate this continual personal narrative, which had the space within each scene as it grew so that you could start to understand the layers, you know, and it would start to grow and be experiential for the audience. So, and this I feel really happy with as far as what audiences have said to me, how far they feel like they've come, you know, in 95 minutes from where the story began to where it ends and the perspective they have and the amount of reflection on what this all meant. It's very gratifying.
Well, just looking at some aspects of the film, it does feel like there's a sense of loss that's permeating from much of what we've seen, not just of Howard himself, but also a lot of the world that he inhabited. There are two aspects to that that you point out specifically, the Chelsea Hotel and the St. Vincent's Hospital. And that's very much a lost world of New York City. And of course, AIDS would have destroyed much of the community that Howard himself must have been a part of too. Was that sense of loss something that you felt as you were exploring the film and researching some of the aspects to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And in the beginning, I mean, I grew up right near St. Vincent's Hospital. You know, my walk from school from the west side of Greenwich Village home past that hospital. And I visited Howard there in the AIDS ward when I was a kid and saw all that from a very young age. And it really filled me with a strange sensation of loss, but a complicated feeling of loss when in about, I think it was 2011, they started to tear down the hospital. And it fed into a lot of things. I mean, one, they were taking away a hospital that serves, I don't know how many, tens of thousands to put up a luxury condo, which is just for like an exclusive 10 or 20 rich people, which was, you know, quite wrong. But also it was taking away a real symbol of the AIDS epidemic and what people had gone through in that moment. And I think that was a real awakening moment to me regarding the loss, that memory is not going to just continue on its own. You know, in the same way a lost film is not going to find its way to distribute itself, someone has to do that. And Howard's memory, while it was alive with me, if I didn't do anything with it, would probably be gone with me. And that was a real eye-opening moment that, you know, there needs to be some sort of action. And what can I do? And in my case, I'm a filmmaker. Well, I can try to turn this whole thing into a film and express it so that it's not forgotten.
Do you think that's a mentality that's lost on a lot of people today? Because I do find that in discussions just more generally, that if you mention maybe some sort of filmmaker or an actor or something from someone from the past, and someone will say, oh, I don't know who that is. They can't have been that much of a major player in cinema. And you sort of have to explain to them, well, only because no one has decided to continue talking about them. A lot of the people that we do remember, we only remember because people chose to continue talking about them, don't we?
I think that's true. And I think, you know, there's a big divide between, let's say, Howard's generation, where everything was very physical, right? Artists worked off each other because they lived near each other and they interacted. And versus now, like, you know, the internet age, we feel like we're very connected and it moves very fast. And it's kind of easy to forget that something needs time and prolonged effort in a way. And that was something that really struck me about Howard and his generation and the way they worked, that I was kind of also aware of. I think there's a lot of pressure to move quickly and to communicate about things, and it's quick on to the next thing. Sometimes slowing down and focusing in on why you are who you are, what you really want to say. I mean, even in the case of digital versus film, you know, when Howard was filming, and as you know, they would, film was expensive. You know, it took time to load the camera, to pay for the stock, then to develop. You had to really be clear on what you're recording and why you're recording it and what it's for. And now there's a tendency, because everything's so readily available, you can just pick up a phone or whatever, to film nonstop. But, you know, ultimately it's about what you're communicating, and it's a language, and focusing in on something is a really worthwhile thing to do, you know?
Just looking at the career of Howard, professionally he had quite a sad ending, I suppose you could say, because his final film, Bloodhounds of Broadway, was not a success. It was a critical failure. Audiences did not react to it very nicely. The studio had torn up his original print and put together something of their own assembling. When you look back at the output that Howard achieved cinematically, do you get a sense of maybe a talent that had only really just quite freshly started to develop and perhaps was cut very, very short?
Yeah, absolutely. I look at it like this. I mean, here's a guy who decided to take the impossibly complex world of William Burroughs and turn it into a film that is comprehensible, which hadn't been done, and there was a reason it had never been done. I mean, it was almost impossible. And he could navigate that and turn that into a story. And then he could do the same with Robert Wilson and his world, which is, you know, equally complex and very different from the Burroughs world. And then, having just made two documentaries, you know, at 33, go get, you know, studio funding and like every major star. I mean, Jennifer Grey turned down roles after Dirty Dancing to do Bloodhounds. You know, it was like that kind of a project, and could navigate that. And he did pull it off. And I'm sure had he lived, the cut would have been different. And the studio might have released the film with all five reels instead of missing the third reel, which added to the catastrophe of it. But absolutely, I look at this guy who could have done anything, really, from an artistic point of view or a filmmaker point of view. It would have been really exciting to see what he would have done next. I mean, we've heard things in the process of what he was working on. We found out he had been working on developing a project with David Bowie, for example, another project with Madonna. So there were many new things he would have done, and I'm sure his approach would have been very different. And that's also not just the case with Howard. I feel like when you look at Mapplethorpe and Keith Haring, you know, these were really interesting artists who were pushing the envelope creatively and were also understood the business of things and the politics of things to navigate those worlds, to get their work seen by pretty wide audiences. So, you know, that was a real hit across filmmaking and all arts, what AIDS did.
maybe it's worth explaining the anecdote of the reels, because what happened with that was that the studios first released the film, which had five reels, with one reel less, which is where Madonna was singing also. So one of the critics that destroyed the film said, oh, what a silly thing to do, to produce a film with Madonna and not have Madonna singing. And the story makes no sense. It kind of jumps from one thing to another. And then they found out that the studio was releasing the film with one less reel.
Aaron Bruckner and Paula Vaccaro. Uncle Howard is screening at the BFI South Bank here in London on Sunday. And you can catch Burroughs the Movie from next Wednesday. Nearly at the end of today's show now, but just enough time for a look at this week's Critics' Choice, which brings us another film playing on Mubi as part of a special hand-picked selection by Nicholas Winding Refn. Let me take you now back to 1995. The reign of the internet was yet to take hold, but cable television had well and truly helped the news media mutate into a form of fame-hungry celebrity beast. In fact, the cultural values predicted by Gus Van Sant's dark satire To Die For are so precisely accurate, it's quite unnerving. Let's take a look.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Moretto. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Suzanne Moretto is my married name. My own name is Suzanne Stone. That's my professional name. Suzanne Stone.
When Suzanne Stone steps outside of her house to a crowd of eager television reporters hungry for a story, there's not a hint of trepidation. What for many might be a confronting experience is for her the ultimate achievement. She's on television. What greater honour could there possibly be? Suzanne's terrifying persistence has landed her a job as the weather presenter of a dowdy local broadcaster, the kind with studios located next to a Walmart.
You're on.
Good evening from the WWEN Weather Center. I don't think I need to tell you that today...
She's ambitious, to say the least. And while her husband is happier shopping for an artificial plant to kit out his new local restaurant, this is more than a story of overreaching ambition. Loosely based upon the true story of a teacher who conspired with her students to kill her husband, To Die For is more concerned about the nature of celebrity worship. Like Elle Fanning's doe-eyed model in The Neon Demon, Suzanne isn't especially talented. She name-drops people like Jane Pauley or Maria Shriver not for their work, but for their outfits.
It's true that the road my husband and I chose to travel on was paved with many speed bumps. Larry said he would never stand in my way, whatever happened. But the word failure is not part of my vocabulary. My commitment to my career or my marriage or whatever has always been 110%. Regardless of how fast I was growing in my vocation, I would never leave Larry behind. The word divorce was never mentioned.
Divorce? No. Murder? Maybe. But the genius of To Die For isn't so much that it's unafraid to reach the heights of what might seem absurd, but that it never questions why this is actually an entirely plausible situation. This was the year of the O.J. Simpson trial, which, of course, among many other things, planted the seeds of fame that would one day become the Kardashians. Suzanne is the product of a tabloid culture that not only cultivates narcissism, but rewards those who worship it. We might have swapped our boxy televisions for iPhones, but in a time when elections are fought by whoever provides the best soundbites, the satire at the film's core has probably never been more relevant. Suzanne's ambitions may be on ice for now, but not the cultural norms that inspired her ascendance.
That pretty well brings us up to date, until your phone call, which I must say wasn't entirely unexpected, since in the last few days a number of interesting offers for my story have been literally pouring in from the networks and some major movie studios.
And that indeed brings us to the end of this week's show. To Die For is currently screening on Mubi. Next week, the long-awaited remake of Ghostbusters finally arrives in theatres. How did a silly comedy become so controversial?
Today's show was edited by Claire Crofton and researched by Yulian Goffin. Listen again to this show and find out more over at our website, monocle.com, and be sure to subscribe to the podcast too. You can always get in touch with me by sending an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.